طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a voice out of Gaza, Haider Eid. Haider Eid is Associate Professor of Postcolonial and Postmodern Literature at Gaza's Al-Aqsa University. He has written widely on the Arab-Israeli conflict, including articles published in Zenet, Electronic Intifada, Palestine Chronicle, and Open Democracy. He wrote the following article in Mondeweiss concerning the latest flap over Secretary of State John Kerry's statement concerning the U.S. abstaining on the U.N. resolution concerning the Israeli settlements. Quoting from Haider Eid's article, outgoing Secretary of State John Kerry delivered a speech on December 28th in which he lamented the defunct two-state solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The reason I am using quotation marks here is because what is being described as a conflict is, in fact, a classical case of settler colonialism coupled with apartheid. Therefore, one does not have two equal parties here unless one considered the South African apartheid a conflict between native Africans and white supremacist colonialists. Kerry's main point is that the two-state solution is in danger due to Israel's policy of settlement building. The U.S., as he says, wants to keep the possibility of establishing a viable Palestinian state open. He, however, ignores the fact that Israel has already shot the two-state solution in the head by expanding the existing settlements, by annexing Jerusalem, and by constructing the monstrous apartheid wall, and by turning the Gaza Strip into the largest concentration camp on earth, with 2 million inmates living worse than animals, as President Jimmy Carter described it on his visit to Gaza, all of which have left the Palestinians with almost no land on which they can have a state. Moreover, Kerry basically ignores the fact that the two-state solution is a racist solution par excellence. In fact, the fictional Palestinian state he is referring to is worse than the infamous Bantustans of apartheid South Africa. But more importantly, I think, is his solution to the refugee issue, where he is suggesting an agreed-upon solution, ignoring the fact that the right of return of all Palestinian refugees is guaranteed under international law and in accordance with the UN Resolution 194. There is no solution to the Palestinian question without guaranteeing the refugees' right of return. And he ends up reiterating America's commitment to Israel's security, ignoring the fact that it is the Palestinians who need to be protected from Israel's policy of settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing, and occupation. No wonder, then, that the title of one Israel's mainstream soft Zionist paper, Aretz, op-eds was, Kerry's speech was superbly Zionist, pro-Israel, and 3 years too late. But that is not what the far-right-wing government of Netanyahu thinks. Finally, it is the height of hypocrisy to use the one-state solution, that is, a secular democratic state for all of its citizens, as a scarecrow. The U.S. itself is a secular democratic state, and so is South Africa. Why is it so scary to have this alternative instead of a racist solution? One would think, by the way American politicians carry on defending the racist two-state solution, that they wouldn't mind having 50 independent states in the U.S. itself. The entire world is against Israel, but how are we, Palestinians, going to build on that? The answer comes loud and clear from the Palestinian-led BDS campaign, a total boycott against Israel and divestment from it and from foreign companies benefiting from its multi-tiered system of oppression, namely occupation, colonialization, and apartheid, and the imposition of sanctions against it until it complies with international law. In a nutshell, what we Palestinians need right now is diplomacy of resistance. That was an article featured in Mondo Weiss, written by Haider Eid from Gaza. Our feature presentation this morning is an interview with John Atik, who is visiting the United States from Bethlehem for the first time. The interview is conducted by our colleague, Stephen Lowe, who did this interview exclusively for This Week in Palestine. Here is Stephen Lowe in conversation with John Atik.
So I'm sitting here with John Atik. John just arrived in the United States for the very first time this morning. And a friend of mine asked me to pick him up at the airport and to spend a few hours with him, perhaps letting him sleep after a long journey, and then to get him on a bus to Conway, New Hampshire. And so I thought it would be interesting to begin our conversation by just asking John, why did you come to the Boston area and New England?
Well, first, it has been one of my dreams, actually, to come to the States. And it was made possible by a program that I was enrolled in, which is Wilderness First Responder. And then afterwards, I'm coming to finish this in Conway, New Hampshire. And afterwards, I'm going to take the instructor program in order to become a trainer of trainers and teach people how to become a wilderness first aid and give them the essential skills for that.
So I've been to your homeland a number of times, and I must admit that I've never seen as much snow and mountains where you come from as I've seen in Conway, New Hampshire. What is it that you do back in your homeland? Why don't you tell us where you're from and explain to us what it is that brought you to Conway specifically in that regard?
Okay, well, I'm from Bethlehem, Palestine, and Palestine as a country is a unique place because it has four geographical regions, if I say. Like, we have the coastal side, we have the wilderness of Jerusalem, and we have the Jordan Valley, and we have the mountains. I'm a kind of person that loves nature and like to be in the outdoors, and I spend a good time of my weekend and just exploring and going from one place to another. And the reason that I chose Conway to come to is that I'm going to study at the Solo School, which is based in Conway, New Hampshire. And that's the organization which was going to give me my certificates and credentials.
I see. And so were you born in Bethlehem?
I was born and raised in Bethlehem.
And what kind of education did you have there?
Well, in Bethlehem, according to our schools, first you have the elementary school system, and after that, at the end of the school, there is something called Tawjihi, which is the last class at high school. Now, Tawjihi, first you take an exam first for the school, then the second there is an exam for the Ministry of Education of Palestine. So it's like a nationwide kind of examination. It's very important for you because it decides so many things in your life. If you don't get this certificate, you can lose so many things. So So it's very important for you to get this one. And then, depending on your marks and sometimes your wishes, you are to decide whether to go to the literature section or the scientific section. If you are like into geography, history, you can go to the literature section. If you are into mathematics, physics, all kind of those subjects, you get to go to the scientific section. But still, all of that depends on your grades and marks, what you're good at, and what's suitable to your personality.
And this is the college level that we're talking about now.
Yeah, college.
And so, what did you do? Which side of that equation did you fall on, and which college did you go to?
Well, I went to Terra Santa School in Bethlehem. It's a school just like 1 minute away from the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. So it was very nearby. It's one of the private schools in Bethlehem, one of the best, actually. It's only for boys. But there is also twin sister, like a twin school, twin college, which is called St. Joseph School. It's for girls. So these two schools are the best in Bethlehem, and they are both private. But in my case, I was assigned to go to the literature section and to study geography, art, Arabic language, and those things. But then after I graduated from school, I just had a hobby and just had a thing for technology and IT, computers, and I want to study more about that and get more involved. But the thing is that being at the literature section does not qualify me to study like computer science, which was my dream. And I want to do that, but I can't. So that was a bit of disappointment when I applied to Bethlehem University, and they told me you can't because you are literature section student. So then I started to look for other options, like what can I do? I'm from the literature section, I need to make the best out of it. What should I do? So I had the thought to think about that, and I decided that accounting is going to be maybe one of the solutions, even though that I hate mathematics and I hate numbers and I hate digits. But that's, well, sometimes you just go with the flow, and that's what happened in my case. So I went to Bethlehem University for half a semester and just couldn't continue because it wasn't my thing. And I started to look for other options and like, what should I do with my life? And I heard about a university which is called American World University. It's an online university that give the chance for anyone, whether like it doesn't matter your background, you just get the chance to study whatever you want. So when I heard about it, I wanted to apply. And I did, and I got enrolled into the program and got my major in BA, of course, in computer science. One backdrop for this school is that it's not accredited, but at least it's a certificate and that I'm holding in my hands. But not only that, I even continued and wanted to pursue my future on a better and higher level. That's why I got involved with Microsoft and got 7 titles and certificates from Microsoft, and my education also from Cisco. I have CCNA and CCNP, which is the professional levels. And I just kept going and working in this field as an IT or systems and network engineer for some point, but then I felt that it doesn't pay off. I mean, I need to find something that can secure a good life for me, and being an IT guy wasn't the solution, so again, I had to look for another options, and then I thought, like, I'm a people's person, I like to talk to people, I like to go to meet new people, make some friends, and so on, and I thought about tourism. Tourism was one of my solutions, so I said, okay, I'll get involved in tourism and see how it's going to be like. And Palestine is a touristic destination, so it's the perfect combination for me to be there. That's when I got involved in tourism. First, I started working in a travel agency. I've worked for so many years and gained excellent experience. And on the personal level, like I said, I go out a lot and hike a lot. And so many times I take so many friends around in the neighborhood or the nearby valleys or mountains. We just go and explore. And the idea just became bigger and bigger, and my passion is growing as I go. That is when I got involved even more, when Masar Ibrahim, in cooperation with Bethlehem University, had created a new course, which is to have some licensed trekking guides. And I got enrolled in that program and graduated and got my license. And now I'm working with Masar Ibrahim. It's a hiking trail in Palestine that runs from Rumane, a village in north of Jenin, until Beit Mersim, which is northwest of Hebron. It's 321 kilometers. And I'm working for this organization in which we develop the trail itself and the infrastructure, homestays, waymarking, accommodation, and whatsoever. And I can say I'm pretty much happy where I am now at the moment in terms of my professional level and personal level. And now being here in the States, it's actually a big addition to my skills and my qualifications in which I do. And hopefully after I'm done with that, I'll just go back to Palestine and transfer my knowledge to others so that they can be the same and follow the same footsteps.
How long will you be here in the States? How long is your trip, and what are you going to? What, will you be doing anything else besides just the course that you're taking?
Well, my stay in the United States is going to be up to 40 days. I'll be back in the 1st of February. First, I'm at the moment now, I'm for the wilderness first aid. I'm going to take the next level, which is wilderness first responder. And after that, I'm going to take also a few classes of the EMT. And after that, I'm just going to the instructor program because I have to be one level higher than the original level that I can teach. Like if I want to teach WFA, I need to be WFR, which is I'm going to take.
Is that based on, are there international standards that govern this, or is this a Palestinian set of standards that that determine these various levels?
Organized by, like I said, the solo schools in New Hampshire, and it's an international certificates, and it's also associated with the American Crossheart.
American Red Cross.
American Red Cross, sorry.
That's okay. I'd like to come back to this in a few minutes, but I want to ask you, here in America, people who have information technology, IT backgrounds, not only usually have an easy time finding jobs, but those jobs usually pay very well. Why was that not the case? Why did you find it not to be the case in Palestine?
In Palestine, we have technology, we have all kind of things, but when it comes to technology that's related to IT, I mean, it's not that, if I can say, evolved. I mean, it reached a certain stage where just people have what they need and that's it. They don't need more efficient stuff. They don't look for backup, security, service, and all of that, and it just does not exist much.
Really? Okay. You have a family?
Yeah, I'm married, and I have one daughter who's 2 months and a half.
I see. And where do you and your wife and your daughter live?
Well, we live in Jerusalem, which is one of actually making life a bit tough. Is because she has Jerusalem ID, but I have a Palestinian ID. Now, for my wife to have or to keep all her benefits and her ID, we need to live in Jerusalem. And I work in Beit Sahur, and we need to go back and forth every day from my work, and yet, not to mention that I can't drive in Jerusalem, so I have to rely on her driving me or someone else, or I take public transportation. Sometimes it makes life a bit challenging because going from Jerusalem to the location where we live to my work in Beit Sahur, it takes me up to 2 hours. So that is 2 hours gone from my day for one way, and on the way back it sometimes takes 1 hour and a half, 1 hour, depends on traffic.
Is that every day that you have to do that, or is it only some days?
No, it's actually every day, and especially when I go with transportation, it costs a lot of money. I mean, you're talking here about like $20 a day just going back and forth. That's a lot of money, especially when you're talking that like average salaries in Palestine are like $500, even less than that. So you only can imagine what you can do with that little amount of money. And so you need to plan everything well, you need to save well, and in order to survive.
So under those circumstances, why wouldn't your wife just move to Bethlehem so that you wouldn't have such a long commute?
Well, if we were to move to Bethlehem, my wife will lose all her benefits because she doesn't live in Jerusalem anymore. That's one thing. And the second thing is that up to this moment, my daughter has no ID, no number whatsoever. Because she's Jerusalem ID and I have the Palestinian ID, and that makes things a bit more complicated than it when two people who are like from Jerusalem ID get married. So this is one also from other challenges that we're facing.
My gosh. And what about you? What's the possibility of your finding work in Israel or in Jerusalem? Could you move to Jerusalem and just find a job close to home so you wouldn't have to commute such a long time?
I can do that, yeah. I mean, it's possible. So many people from Bethlehem or the surrounding places work in Jerusalem, and it's doable, but the thing, there's too much hassle with it. I mean, if I want to work in Jerusalem, I need to go back and forth as well, and I can't drive, like I said, so it makes life so much harder because I can't drive, and I need to rely on other people, and I'm not that kind of person that likes to rely on people when he wants to do anything. I just like to do things of my own. So working in Jerusalem and finding the suitable work for me, that's going to be tricky because I love my job and I love what I do with Mazar Ibrahim. And it happens to be in Beit Sahur.
I see. And why can't you drive in Jerusalem?
I guess it's just the law. Because, I'm simply not allowed because I'm Palestinian and I can't drive an Israeli registered car in Jerusalem.
And there's no way around that. There's no driver's test that you could take that would permit you to get a license. That's just because it's based on your ethnicity, your nationality, that decision is made.
Yeah. I can't do anything. I mean, even though, like, at the age of 38, which is still far away, so many years from now, I'm 28 at the moment, at the age of 35, there's something which is called a family reunion kind of thing, is that my wife will just like adding me or joining me to her family. I will have some special kind of permit, and maybe, just maybe, if it happened in like after so many years, I might be able to get a temporary Jerusalem ID, or maybe not. And then the temporary ID also maybe become permanent ID, but that's still a long stage and long process, and it will take so much time.
So the fact that you that it's not lawful for you to drive in Jerusalem, is it lawful for you to live in Jerusalem? Is that permitted?
As long as I have the permit, yes.
I see.
If I don't, no. I mean, when we used to be engaged, I didn't have a kind of permit, only the permit that we have during Christmas and Easter. So other than that, I wouldn't have any permit, and it was hard for me to visit my fiancée when we were engaged because I didn't have a permit. So she had to come to Bethlehem to visit me, but then at the same time, she can't stay late because, she's a girl driving alone at night, and it's not a thing that we prefer.
So you're able to live legally in Jerusalem, but the Israeli government won't allow you to legally drive in Jerusalem.
Yes, you are right.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about what's involved in getting these permits? You said it's a complicated process. Do you have to hire a lawyer to help you? Is it expensive? Does it just take time?
Well, some people actually prefer to hire a lawyer, but it is expensive to hire one. Alternatively, you can do it yourself. It can take a little bit more time. But to get a permit, you need a purpose for that. So one of the purposes is that first, which is most people get it, which is for like holidays, like whether it was Christian or Muslim, they get permits for holidays. Second, it's a work permit, and third, it can be a permit for any other reason, like it can be that you are a tour agent, you can get a permit, and if you are a merchant, you can get a permit, And even if you want to go to the hospitals to get treatment, you can get a permit. So there are different kind of permits, but not all of them as easy as it sounds. I mean, there's you need to go through the procedures, and if you got the security clearance, and if you were accepted, and you will take it. If not, you won't.
So the permit that you have now, you're in the travel industry. So do you have a travel permit, a travel industry permit that
yes.
permits you to go?
Yes.
And is that why you're able to live in Jerusalem?
Yes.
And if it were not for the fact that you were in the travel industry, would you be able to live in Jerusalem?
No, I wouldn't.
I see. Okay. So in addition to being able to live in Jerusalem, that would mean that you could fly from Israel directly to another country without going through Amman. Is that correct? Is that what you did this time?
Well, it's not entirely correct. I mean, for any person who's Palestinian to fly out of the country, they need to go to Jordan and cross through Allenby Bridge and waste a day of traveling just between those three borders, and the Palestinian and then the Israeli and the Jordanian border. It's so much procedures to go through. But what I did in my case is that I applied for a permit to fly from Tel Aviv airport, and I got a permit because it's Christmas time and I'm flying through Christmas time, and they have this kind of like a ease of traveling for us, and that's why I got the permit and flew from Tel Aviv.
So even though you're legally able to live in Jerusalem because you're in the travel industry, you're not able to drive legally, and you would, other than this special holiday travel permit, you wouldn't be able to go to Ben-Gurion Airport legally. What other restrictions, what other things can't you do once you're in Israel that most people would find surprising?
Well, one of the other things that, for example, my wife has insurance, I don't, and I can't have one. I only have my Palestinian insurance, but not the Israeli insurance.
So if you were to get sick when you were in Jerusalem, how would you be treated? Could you go to the doctor, or is there a doctor that would treat you?
Well, I can be treated in Jerusalem, but I need to pay private costs. So it's going to cost a big amount of money, and it's a money that I don't owe at the moment.
I see. Now, does your wife ever go to visit you in Bethlehem? Does she visit your family in Bethlehem?
Oh, yeah, we go. I mean, sometimes we go to see my family and my brother and my sisters. We do that. But it doesn't happen often because having a kid makes life a bit different than it used to be. And my wife is only driving, like I said, and I can't drive. So she'll be driving, and, you know, like when you get to stay late here and there, and sometimes during the day will be so tired, and she will do all the driving herself. Like, but I want to make it easier for her to drive, but I can't. So at the same time, it's like you can't do anything about it. So that's why we tend not to go much or not to go for far places, and just stay within the area.
And with your travel permit that lets you into Jerusalem, I assume you can travel pretty much throughout Israel as well. Is that right?
Yes, except I can't go to Eilat. That's the only place that I can't go.
Really? And why is that?
Well, for me, you know, I think it's just the law, because that's what it says for everybody. But the only thing that I have just on the top of my head, I'm just speaking out loud, is that Eilat is tax-free. So if everyone, just all the Palestinians, got the chance to go to Eilat, I think the situation will be a bit more different than that.
I see.
So I think this is the reason, but I'm not quite sure.
Interesting. In terms of going to Eilat, are there checkpoints you would have to pass through, or is it a situation where you would simply be in fear of being caught when somebody asked you for an ID that indicated that you didn't have a permit to be there? How would that work?
Well, there are several checkpoints between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. There are actually three. One of them, which is checkpoint 300, and which we also call it Rachel's Tomb checkpoint. And that's the only checkpoint that has a terminal in which all Palestinians and other people, even the internationals, need to go on foot. And inside you have security checks, whether it was like scans, x-ray, fingerprints, and all of that. So after you pass that, you cross to the other side, and we also have a checkpoint which is in Beit Jala or near Walaj. It's called Walaj checkpoint. I can't go through that because it has no terminal and no security checks, and just there are just cars driving through the checkpoint. And the third one, which is DCO checkpoint, and it's the same as Walaj. So I'm only allowed through one checkpoint between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, which is the 300 checkpoint.
Right. And if you were in one of those cars, then presumably you would be entering Israel in a car that was not... Do those cars get stopped when they...
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they stop cars. And if you were one of them, it wouldn't be a nice situation.
It wouldn't be. The security people would detain you or interrogate you or arrest you.
Okay. So
let me get back to the question of your guide business, the work that you're doing as a guide, a wilderness guide. Have you been able to visit the guide work in Israel itself, or is it all in Palestine?
Well, most of the Palestinian guides work in Palestine only. But for those the Palestinians who works in Israel, are only 43 guides according to the agreement between the Ministry of Tourism in Palestine and Israel. So in Israel they have like thousands of guides, but in Palestine only 43 that can have access to Jerusalem and to other areas to guide. Now, the only situation, like if I want to apply for that permit, it's going to be tough because there are like so much people on the waiting list, and you just don't get a permit handed over for you just like that. The only possibility for you to get a permit, which is ironic, in which if someone like passed away and you to take over and take his permit, but that's the only thing.
I see. But has that prevented you from actually doing any wilderness trekking in Israel? As a person who's in the region, can you do that privately and not as a guide?
Sometimes when you go to certain regions, you need to have a permit, and it becomes quite challenging because even though like I have a permit and I can go to those areas, but the people who are with me can't go to those areas. So there's so much to see, but yet you are so limited because you don't have a permit in normal situations.
So for people listening to this program who would be interested in seeing parts of Palestine that you work in as a guide, where are some of the places that you would take these people, and what kinds of activities are there that you would be able to show them?
Well, they can focus, I can focus and show them the beauty of Palestine when it comes to culture, when it comes to tradition, to our daily lives and whatsoever. So, like, I would start maybe with a hike for them, for starting from Jericho, which is the lowest and the oldest city in the world. And we can do that and navigate our way through the wilderness of Jerusalem, meet with some Bedouins, have meals, get to know more about the Bedouin lifestyle and how do they live and how they can manage their life. They have so many challenges. One of them, which is especially water, because, living in the wilderness of Jerusalem is a very tough place, and you need to secure water and food and so many things for your family. So we focus more on the marginalized communities in which we can support them, whether it was, through... when sending groups to them, we can support them through preparing meals or letting people sleep for the night, some kind of Bedouin tents and accommodations. So this is part of what we can do. Also, they will pass by historical and ancient places in which they can know more about Palestine, about the history and the culture, the civilizations that had a great effect on Palestine and all of those things.
So it sounds as though when people come to Palestine and experience the beauty of the country and seeing, a land that's very foreign to those of us, for example, here in New England, there's a flip side to that, and that is that there's a benefit to the economy because the services that that these people receive during the course of that visit really helps the economy by giving them an opportunity to provide those services. Is that that's got to be important to them, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been to Spain and I've hiked on El Camino de Santiago. And what I felt is that I'm not meeting many people. I mean, it has so many people walking, and I joined meeting so much people. But I wasn't in touch with the local community. This thing was missing. But when it comes to Masar Ibrahim, well, it's actually focused on the community. It's a community-based walking trail. So it gives you a different kind of experience, an experience which touches your soul in so many different aspects. And shows you like the meaning of life and how to be a person and living as a local.
So, if people are interested in learning more about Masar Ibrahim, how would they do that?
Well, first you can go online. Our website is called masaribrahim.bs. That's one thing.
How do you spell that?
Masar Masar Ibrahim Ibrahim.bs. Alternatively, there is also a Facebook page. It's very active, which is called Masar Ibrahim. And you can go online and check it out.
I see. Some people think that going to this region is not safe, whether it's Israel or Palestine. And what can you... Do you have any comment about the safety and how people should feel about safety if they were to take a trip through the wilderness of Palestine?
I actually have so many comments, and it's good that you mentioned this topic because it's one of the important things, and I'm sure so many people think about the same question. Is it safe to visit Palestine? Now, I can say that it's perfectly safe to visit Palestine. And what you hear in the media, they're just exaggerating and make it feel like as if it's a war zone. I mean, some clashes tend to happen. But those areas in which clashes happen like are very known, and you can simply avoid those places. And even though if something happened, you won't be anywhere near that, and you're 100% safe and it comes to safety. And in Palestine, we have 2.4 million person per year that visits Palestine, whether it's Bethlehem, Annapolis, Jenin, Jericho, and all those places. So we're talking about a huge amount of people that visit Palestine regularly. And have you heard anyone who got attacked or got something? No, you won't, because it does not exist.
So if somebody were to contact you and say they'd like to come to Palestine, what would be the first thing you'd recommend in terms of some tourism and trekking?
Well, it depends, what do you want exactly? The most important thing is that we have the diversity in the itineraries. If you are into hiking, you can have a hiking program. If you want into biking, you can have a biking program. If you want to mix between religious and hiking, you can do that. We have one of the nice trails that we also have in Palestine, which is called the Nativity Trail, in which retraces the footsteps of Jesus and Virgin Mary walking from Nazareth to Bethlehem. Of course, it's not the actual footsteps, but it's a symbolic path that crosses so many different cities, and it's very, very attractive, and it's a very nice one.
And do you provide these tours for only groups of people, or can people go individually or with a family? How does that work?
Actually, it's all kind of peoples. Whether you are a group and you want to organize a hiking activity or adventure activity, we can do that. And if you were individual travelers, we can do that. And if you have bringing your family over, we can recommend a few sections and hikes that are suitable or family friendly, and which is perfectly safe. And if you want extreme activities, you got that too. So you have the whole package, and it's up to you to decide what do you want, and everything can be customized.
I see. Yeah, very good. And it sounds like for people in America, certainly, English is not a problem if they're going to meet guides like you, because you speak English very well. How commonly will people find English spoken in Palestine for trips like this?
Almost everyone in Palestine speaks English. I mean, you start with ABC starting from the kindergarten, and that's why you're just you'll find so many people so good in English. First, you know, our mother tongue is Arabic, then there is English. Then, depending on the school that you go to, there's some schools teach Italian, some schools teach French, some schools teach German. So, at least every student or every Palestinian person knows two languages, English and Arabic, some schools plus another language.
Very good. So, John, is there anything else that you'd like to tell the audience for this week in Palestine about either why you're here or why they should come to see you when you return in another month and a half?
Well, for the people who are listening to this podcast, I'm going to tell you that we are most welcome to come to Palestine, and we like to meet you, whether it was, like, no matter what was your background, your faith, anything. You just come to Palestine and you visit, and you see the world from your own eyes and not from the way you see it on TV.
Okay. Well, John, I think you're headed up to snow country later today, and I hope you have a heavy coat and that you'll be able to enjoy being in New England. And I thank you very much for visiting us here in Boston, in the Boston area, and wish you safe travels and a good trip home. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel it's my honor to be here and with your company, and I look forward to come back again.
That was John Atik, visiting the United States from Bethlehem, in conversation with Stephen Lowe. And finally, interesting insights into internal Gazan politics by Gazan journalist Isra Saleh El-Nami, who writes, "Tens of thousands of Palestinians took to the street in December in Gaza to mark the 29th anniversary of the establishment of Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement that governs the besieged strip. A military parade of Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, thrilled demonstrators as Hamas leaders delivered speeches affirming the group's ongoing commitment to military resistance against the Israeli occupation as the only way to liberate Palestine. However, this year the anniversary came amid mounting challenges facing Hamas on the domestic front and within the international arena. The Palestinian community is still plagued by the internal division between Hamas and its rival Palestinian liberation movement, Fatah. This year has witnessed many desperate attempts to bridge the fences between the two sides, but none achieved significant progress or made a breakthrough. Fayez Abu Shalmala, a Gaza-based commentator, said that achieving internal unity is a pressing need for Hamas that should not be overlooked. The Palestinians and their fair cause have fallen victims to this split. We have lost a lot because both Hamas and Fatah refuse to show flexibility or make concessions for the sake of achieving internal unity and reconciliation, Abu Shalmaha said. He went on to note that Fatah continues to completely dodge its responsibilities toward Gaza, also exacerbating the situation further by contributing to Gaza's acute unemployment and electricity crisis. Fatah's obstinacy propels Gaza's woes to drag on indefinitely, and the people of Gaza have already paid a heavy price. For Hamas, its conditions for achieving reconciliation are guarantees from Fatah to completely recognize the workers in the public sector in the besieged territories. It does not seem that these two main obstacles are about to be resolved. Both have to show mutual zeal to restore the international unity and not to abide by their narrow interests, Abu Shalmaha pointed out. The Palestinian internal split dates back to 2007 when Hamas and Fatah battled each other at the streets in Gaza after Fatah refused to recognize the results of the 2006 legislative elections that Hamas won by a landslide. Since then, Hamas has continued to run Gaza while the Palestinian Authority governs Palestinian sections of the occupied West Bank. Since the beginning of the so-called Arab Spring, Hamas has been confronted with the additional challenge of international and regional isolation. Hamas noticeably lost the support of Syria and Iran when it refused to participate in the atrocities perpetrated by the Syrian regime against the Syrian people. Hamas leadership was then expelled from Syria in 2012, and Iranian financial and military support has dried up. 2 years later, the movement has reduced the strain of this dilemma by opening new channels with more countries which adopt friendly positions toward the Palestinian cause. Khalid El-Kadomi, a Hamas official, said that his group is seeking unconditional support that aims to strengthen and consolidate the Palestinian resistance and provide the beleaguered Palestinians with financial support amidst a plummeting economy and soaring unemployment. We have worked tirelessly to maintain Hamas's international and regional relations to garner adequate support for the Palestinian cause and to encourage solidarity toward Gaza's ordeal, he added. El-Kadomi noted that there are countries that agree to unconditionally support the Palestinians, while other countries choose to keep their support private. In addition, there are some Arab countries that he did not name that are still reluctant to talk with Hamas. What is essential, said the official, is to separate Palestine from the ongoing conflicts in the Arab region. He admitted that as violence ravages the region, the Palestinian cause is no longer seen as a core issue. However, Hamas, he added, looks forward to seeing the Arab world united and in peace to support the Palestinians' gains in their liberation mission. It is noteworthy to say that last year has witnessed some attempts from Hamas to restore relations with Iran, which has included high-ranking delegations of Hamas members to visit Tehran. Hamas officials refused to talk in detail about the development. Iran used to be the biggest financial and military strategist supporter for Hamas, and it seems that the group has failed to fully compensate for the Iranian loss. Hamas is expected to elect a new head and members for its political bureau in the coming months. This was driven by increasing calls from the group's adherents, but it remains unclear whether the new political bureau will adopt new tactics and be more capable in responding to the growing challenges that confront Hamas. However, the most pressing need for Hamas at the current moment is to improve the work of its government in the Gaza Strip. The joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade and the suffocating restrictions imposed against Gaza to punish Hamas have taken a heavy toll on the people, and Hamas has to exert more effort to make their life easier and reduce the blockade's strain. Hamas has succeeded in building an internal infrastructure of charities in Gaza to support impoverished people, but more can be done to delegitimize the collective punishment of the siege. Hamas has shed light, using its media presence, on how awful and inhumane the blockade is. But that does not exclude the need for diplomatic successes to garner the international support and lift the siege once and for all. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.